Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. And it's my great pleasure to introduce Naomi Schaefer Riley, the author of Till Faith Do Us Part. When I was, heard about the project, I liked it right away because it's difficult to talk about subjects that are very realistically trying to do an analysis of something that's very romantic in our society. Because anything that's romanticized in our society or idealized too much, it's very hard to deal with the facts about. So glad that you came to hear about the facts. Thank you very much for coming.
Put away the gavel. Thanks for coming out tonight. So, let's see. Theirs was a storybook romance. She says she fell in love with him on their first date, a motorcycle ride around Los Angeles. A year later, he proposed at the top of the Eiffel Tower. And it wasn't long before they married at a 15th-century castle outside of Rome, with 150 of their closest friends and family standing by. As you may have heard, their story ended unhappily, torn apart, some have claimed, over differences of faith. She wanted their daughter to get a nice Catholic education like the one she had at Notre Dame Academy in Toledo. He, on the other hand, wanted to send the 5-year-old to learn about Scientology on a cruise ship. The Tom Cruise-Katie Holm match may sound like a strange example of interfaith marriage, but there are actually a few ways in which this odd couple is representative of the trends that I want to talk to you about this evening. First, interfaith marriage is on the rise. Second, people who are in interfaith marriages tend to get married later in life. Third, interfaith couples don't discuss their religious differences much before getting married. And fourth, raising children in interfaith marriages in interfaith homes is not easy. Fifth, interfaith marriages actually have lower rates of marital satisfaction and in some combinations, higher rates of divorce. So in July of 2010, I conducted a study, a survey of actually 2,500 Americans. It was done by a survey polling company called YouGov. And the survey showed an interfaith marriage rate of 42%. That included mainline Protestants who were married to evangelicals, but it did not include members of different denominations who were both mainline or both evangelical. So if you throw all the Protestants into one category, you get an interfaith marriage rate of about 36%. So take that number and compare it, if you will, to the General Social Survey, which in 2006 found an interfaith marriage rate of 25%, and in 1988 found a rate of only 15%. So in my opinion, this trajectory seems pretty likely to continue. The survey called the National Study of Youth and Religion found that actually a quarter of 18 to 23-year-olds think it's important to marry someone of the same faith. Marriages between people of two different faiths are becoming more common in every area of the country and for men and for women, regardless of educational status or income level. None of these factors will affect the likelihood that a person will marry someone of another faith. Members of some religious groups are, broadly speaking, more likely to marry out than others. Jews are the most likely, and Mormons are the least likely to marry members of other faiths. Muslims, Catholics, and Protestants fall somewhere in the middle. Many parents and religious leaders I've encountered assume that young adults who intermarry are actually people who were never particularly attached to their churches or synagogues or mosques growing up. But my survey actually suggests otherwise. Childhood religious experiences, it turns out, are not very good predictors of who will marry out. People in same faith and interfaith marriages were equally likely to say that they attended Sunday school very often, to characterize their family growing up as very religious, and to say that they attended religious services every single week. It's possible, I think, that religious practices in childhood are actually just too far removed in the minds of young adults thinking about marriage. However frequent the church attendance, however significant the Sunday school curriculum, and however fervent one's own family, these factors, I think, are no match for the decade or more that now elapsed between leaving a childhood home and the time that we get married. The one useful demographic predictor of whether a person will marry out is the age at which he or she marries. So the older you are when you wed, the more likely you'll marry someone of another faith. 48% of people who are married between 16 and 25 are in interfaith marriages, compared with 58% of people who are married between the ages of 26 and 35, and 67% of people married between 36 and 45. In part, I think these statistics can be explained by the fact that the very religious are more likely to marry young and less likely to marry outside their faith. But the rising age of marriage in America, I think, is also indirectly responsible for the higher interfaith marriage rate. The period between when a child leaves his or her parents' home and when he or she starts a family has long been what people considered a kind of religious downtime. Young people move around, they date different people, they drop in and out of schools, they try out different jobs. In fact, they have few institutional ties, religious or otherwise. You may recognize these non-committal types. They respond Evite to every, to every Evite they receive. As these odyssey years, what David Brooks has called the time between college and marriage, grow longer, the attachment to faith grows more and more tenuous, I think. Indeed, after several years of living in a kind of single netherworld, many young people don't think of themselves as religious at all. They are meeting their mates at a point in life when they have been away from religion for a very long time. The amount of time that we date before marriage now has grown longer, to the point where many young people do not make much of a connection between who they choose to date and who they will eventually marry. So where do you cross the line between a significant relationship and a future spouse? When do issues like religious worldviews actually come into play? So I remember a conversation with a good friend in high school. We'll call him Jacob. During the senior year of high school, Jacob was, he would classify himself as a Reformed Jew, but he had a strong religious education. His family was very attached to the faith. They went to synagogue very often. And during high school, Jacob had dated girls of all different faiths. But as college approached, he told me that he had made a resolution. Starting the first day of college, his freshman year, he would only date Jewish girls. And his reasoning kind of startled me, I have to say. Any of these relationships he was starting now, he explained, could end in marriage. And he had no intention of marrying someone who wasn't Jewish. Marriage? Who was thinking about marriage? We were 17-year-olds from northeastern upper-middle-class families. We were going off to four-year colleges to find ourselves. We were not thinking about marriage. I thought he was crazy. But Jacob already kind of knew himself. And within the first few months of college, he had actually found a girl, a Jewish one. And by the time he turned 23, he had married her. Jacob, needless to say, is the exception. Most young adults wait longer to think about such things. But young adults dating those of other faiths may wonder, how much time should we be in a relationship before we discuss our beliefs or the faith of our future children? Many couples actually seem to cross this line without realizing it. Fewer than half of the survey respondents actually in interfaith marriages talked about how they were going to raise their children before they got married. Fewer than half had this conversation at all. On his blog, Single Dad Laughing, parenting writer Dan Pierce described a recent conversation with his son about the difference between his own religious beliefs and those of the boy's mother from whom he's divorced. She is a devout church-going Christian, and I am a spiritual agnostic, he explains. Up until this point, Pierce tells readers, it hasn't really been too big a deal when it comes to co-parenting our son. I let him go to church with her, and she lets me take him hiking. We have a mutual agreement that we'll both always be passionate about our personal beliefs, but never tell the boy what he must believe. But then the boy started asking questions like, Daddy, why don't you like church? And Daddy, don't you know that Jesus made everything in the world? For a parenting author, Pierce was strangely surprised by these questions from his five-year-old. Wait till the kid wants to know where babies come from. Pierce kept telling the boy that it was his choice and what he wanted to do and believe. And by the end of the conversation, he was a much happier camper, according to Pierce. Now, I have never met Dan Pierce or his son, but I doubt this is the last conversation they're going to have about this. He also, by the way, might think that he and his ex have a level playing field when it comes to trying to raise their son. But according to my survey, children are about twice as likely to adopt the faith of their mother as the faith of their father. Americans are mostly reluctant to raise their children in more than one faith. About 80% of same-faith couples raise their kids in one faith, and 20% raise them in no faith. And here's the situation for interfaith couples. So a plurality, you can see, raise their children in one faith. About a third are raising their kids in no faith, and about 20% are trying to do both. But it becomes actually pretty interesting when you look at the situation broken down by the age of the children. So, as you can see here, as kids get older, both becomes harder. In families with kids under the age of five, 24% of people said they were raising kids in both faiths. That number dropped to 21% in couples with children age 5 to 11 and dropped again to 18% with kids age 12 to 18. So most of the interfaith couples that I interviewed suggest that raising kids in both faiths is actually impractical or in some cases unfair to the children. And it seems that as time went on, it became even more impractical. I interviewed one couple where they were actually raising their kids both Jewish and Catholic. And the mother did say to me it was a good thing that their children were not athletic, because if they had to add team sports to going to synagogue and going to church every weekend, she just did not think it was going to work out. So many Americans think there's something worthwhile about sharing a faith with one spouse. A higher percentage of married Americans believe it is very important for a happy marriage that a husband and wife have the same religion. More think that than say that they should have the same level of education, the same race, or the same political views. Even people in interfaith couples I interviewed actually suggested that all things being equal, it was better to have the same faith as your spouse. So no doubt there are just simply cases where a young couple falls in love and they're convinced that they will be the exception and that religious differences will not become an issue in their own marriage. Of course, love and young love in particular has always been blind. But our cultural messages today, I think, really reinforce the idea that marriage is a purely individual choice and that the most ideal matches are really the ones that occur by happenstance. Making a list of traits, including religion, that one is looking for in a mate, and then searching methodically for someone who matches them is just not as likely to appeal as finding one's soulmate. You can compare these two approaches to dating and see which you find sort of more romantic. Anyway, but there are pressures other than romantic ones, I think, namely the cultural pressures of pluralism that are pushing some people toward interfaith marriage. Some young Americans even pride themselves on marrying someone very different from themselves. One woman I spoke to who was brought up Catholic recalled her thoughts on dating when she went off to college. She told me, "To limit yourself to only people of your own religion seemed bigoted. There's a whole world of people that I don't know. To write them off as potential partners before she met them," she told me, "seemed rude." The language, I think, is revealing. It's as if society's institutional rules about hiring an employee or admitting someone to college have actually morphed into our rules for dating now. Some young people have adopted the idea that we need more diversity in our marriage. It seems to go against our national grain now to ask people about the religious beliefs on a date, even if we suspect it might affect the long-term prospects for our marriages. And so we agree to put aside our differences for the sake of true love. But faith, I think, is a tricky thing, and it sneaks up on people. The death of a loved one, the birth of a child, the loss of a job, a move to a new city. All of these things, I think, give people a sense of religious longing, or they can do that, a desire to return to the faith of their childhood. Some people will pursue that desire, occasionally to the detriment of their marriages, and others, I think, will suppress that desire, and sometimes even thwart their own spiritual journeys. One man I spoke with felt that the more involved he became with his Catholic Church, the further he was pushing himself away from his Jewish wife and their children. So he's just stopped going altogether. He told me that though his desire to pursue his spiritual path was important, people in a marriage are not sovereign selves. Another woman, and this was a very strange, long kind of soap opera story, but the punchline, I shouldn't call it punchline, it was sort of sad, was on the way home from the hospital after the birth of her second child, her husband announced that he was leaving the Catholic Church and he wanted to become Eastern Orthodox. No one apparently told him this is not the kind of thing you want to announce to a woman on the way home from the hospital after the birth of a child, but leaving that aside, their entire lives up until that point had revolved around being members of the Catholic Church and being part of this small parish. The priest would come over for dinner, and all of a sudden he just said, "That's not what I believe anymore." So what is the fate of these couples? In general, most Americans actually have pretty happy marriages, and it would be odd if they didn't, because it's pretty easy to get divorced. So if you were really miserable, you'd probably be out of it. So most Americans have an average, a sort of baseline level of 8 on a scale of 1 to 10. That may seem high for you, I don't know. But anyway, that's what a sociologist called the marital satisfaction rate. But even with that high floor, we did find that same-faith couples are more satisfied than interfaith ones. Marriage counselors have long known that the most harmonious marriages are the ones in which the husband and wife have the most in common. The notions that opposites attract may be a good way of explaining why your straight-laced daughter just ran off with that guy on the motorcycle, but there's not a lot of sociological evidence to back it up. So here is how satisfied people are in their marriages, broken down by religious tradition. The difference in marital satisfaction between same and interfaith marriages varies, obviously, across religious traditions. While it's nearly always the case that people in same-faith marriages report a happier relationship than those in interfaith ones, the gap is bigger for some groups than others. Now, I should say, before we get sort of down into these questions, there are not enough Jews in my sample to be statistically significant. Out of 2,500 people, there were only 44 Jews in the survey. So these numbers may look strange, and you may find it odd, for instance, that Jews are happier in interfaith marriages than in same-faith marriages, or you may find that telling of something. I don't know. But we will talk about later, there's actually also a higher divorce rate among Jews in interfaith marriages, which I found too. But again, the statistical significance is hard to draw. But getting back to the sort of more general points, there are certainly interfaith couples whose marital satisfaction actually seems very much like that of same-faith couples. For instance, there's very little difference you can see between Catholics in same-faith and interfaith marriages. These findings are not surprising. Most Catholics tend to have a less exclusivist understanding of God and faith and can probably more easily assimilate the idea of a partner who does not share their views. When we look at the religious traditions of the respondent, we find the biggest gap is for evangelicals married to non-evangelicals and black Protestants who are in interfaith marriages. So what is it about being an evangelical or a black Protestant married to someone outside the church? Well, if you believe that there is a single path to salvation and your partner is not going to achieve it, you're probably not going to be thrilled about that. And, you know, there's also just sort of a, you know, general idea of how the faith is practiced and, you know, to what extent those two things are compatible within the same marriage. Sort of there are also all these more practical issues that religion affects. There's an economist named Evelyn Lehrer who did a study in 1993 of interfaith marriages, and she pointed out that a strong or even a moderate religious faith will influence many activities that a husband and wife perform jointly. It's not just church on Sunday, of course, but religion also affects how you raise your children, how you spend your time, money, friendships, professional networks, and it can even influence where you decide to live. So these disagreements between a husband and wife start to add up. People who attend church more often seem more bothered by the interfaith nature of their relationship than the people who don't attend church. So if you want to imagine this, it's typically a woman who's the one who's more frequently going to be attending services. She is kind of stewing at church while the husband is sitting at home perfectly happy by himself. And you can see that this is not a very new idea. Here is Norman Rockwell sort of depicting the man sitting at home, even before there was Sunday pregame football to watch. I like the little boy, particularly on the side, sort of wondering when it's going to be his turn to get to stay home. Anyway, so let me be clear here. It's not that interfaith couples, I think, spend some significant part of their lives arguing about abstract doctrinal ideas. Half of the respondents in same-faith couples and 46% of interfaith couples report never disagreeing about faith at all, which makes sense. I don't think Jewish wives and Christian husbands typically spend a lot of time arguing about whether Jesus was the Son of God. Once you've had that argument once, it's not really going anywhere. You're probably not going to keep going at it. Well, some couples will, but it's another story. So what about divorce? When I did a simple comparison between the currently married and the divorced in the survey, I found no difference in the proportion who are in same-faith and interfaith marriages. But some religious combinations I found significantly more likely to end up in divorce than others. So in general, Catholics are no more likely to divorce when married to someone of the same faith than when married to a non-Catholic. But divorce is roughly 10 percentage points more common among Catholics who marry evangelicals. Indeed, evangelicals are more likely to divorce when married to someone of almost any other religion. So while roughly a third of evangelical marriages end in divorce, that number climbs to half for marriages between evangelicals and non-evangelicals. It is especially high, though, for evangelicals married to someone of no religion, 61%. So with the relatively small number of Jews in the sample, as I said, their inclusion here is somewhat tenuous, but with the caveat that these numbers are small, it is striking that the frequency of divorce more than doubles for marriages between a Jew and a non-Jew, which is bad news for him. So none of these findings is particularly new. A 1993 study found that if two members of mainline Christian denominations marry, they have a 1 in 5 chance of being divorced. A Catholic and a member of an evangelical denomination have a 1 in 3 chance, and a Jew and a Christian who marry have a greater than 40% chance of being divorced in 5 years. So according to the American Religious Identification Survey, which had 35,000 people, people in mixed religion marriages were 3 times more likely to be divorced than those who are in same-faith marriages. So this is Albert Gordon, and he talked about this a long time ago. He wrote a book in 1964 on intermarriage. And he said, basically, whether or not religious difference in these cases is only one of the factors that has resulted in the ultimate dissolution of marriage, the fact is that interfaith marriages fail in far greater numbers than intrafaith ones. He said, if I were a betting man, I would certainly not wager against such odds. So, now that you're all thoroughly depressed, I would like to take a few steps back and just talk about how interfaith marriages affects particular religious communities and the country as a whole. So most people think interfaith marriage is a Jewish issue. I don't know how many of you have seen this chart before, but it sort of loomed large in my childhood. This is sort of supposed to show you diminishing numbers of Jews as a result of intermarriage. In 1990, the Jewish Population Survey revealed that the interfaith marriage rate had arrived at 50%. And I can still remember rabbis talking about how the Holocaust didn't kill us off, but surely intermarriage was going to. So the rate has actually pretty much plateaued for Jews since then, though it is obviously still a significant subject of discussion in both the Reform and conservative Jewish communities. Jewish leaders have so far mostly focused on the problems they've had convincing Jews to marry in the faith, but they've not paid as much attention, I think, to what happens after intermarriage. That's starting to change a little bit, but it's still an issue. There is an acknowledgement, actually, that pushing conversion might be a good idea. But Jews are pretty new to this idea, and they're not quite sure how to go about it. And when they do, they're often timid and deeply concerned about offending non-Jewish spouses. Or they simply want to make it seem like Judaism is compatible with the spouse's agnosticism or secularism or atheism. This is understandable, but I think America is a thriving religious marketplace. And if Jews are going to compete, they should have a little more confidence in their message. So I went and talked to my childhood rabbi. I grew up in Massachusetts, but my childhood rabbi is now in Seattle. And he actually seemed to be one of the Jewish leaders I spoke with who seemed to be kind of aware of this problem. He recently had returned from spending a month in India, and he had been talking to some Hindu immigrants who were concerned about their children losing the faith. And he asked them pointedly, "Do you assume that because you came from India that your children are going to, by osmosis, feel attached to Hinduism? Just because you have memories of this from your childhood, that is not going to happen." He told them about the Jewish experience. He said, "This is not 1950 where everyone spoke Yiddish and lived in the same Jewish neighborhood. This is America. It's the most open society in the history of the world." So there's perhaps no group in America that understands the nature of the thriving religious marketplace better than evangelicals. They understand the need to keep people in the fold, and it helps that, obviously, for them, proselytizing comes with the territory. But evangelicals have their own set of challenges when it comes to interfaith marriages. First of all, they have the no men in church problem. So a number of the pastors that I've spoken with describe how single women in their communities often decide to date and marry outside the church because they don't find any eligible men sitting in the pews. They come to church every week looking to find somebody, and they're not there. So it's common, and I think probably good advice, to tell men and women that they should not plan on having their significant other change in any significant way. Women who expect their husbands to become more neat or organized or affectionate after 20 years of marriage are often disappointed, as are men who think women will be less demanding, more interested in professional sports, or bigger fans of lingerie. Another example of how this doesn't work. But in the case of religion, there actually seems to be some reason to hold out hope that changing a spouse is possible. My survey actually asked people in same-faith marriages, before you were married, did you and your spouse have the same religion? 25% of people who are in same-faith marriages say that they and their spouse did not have the same religion at the beginning of their marriage. So this, I think, is a pretty strikingly large number. It demonstrates not just the fluidity of American attitudes toward religion, but it also suggests that a spouse can actually have a pretty significant influence over one's religious choices. So the question of how Christians can be steadfast in their own faith while remaining active and welcoming in the world is not easy, but it is made more complicated, I think, by the issue of interfaith marriage. Over the past several years, I've interviewed a lot of young evangelicals, and they have proudly told me that they are not those types of evangelicals. They don't knock on doors. They don't pass out pamphlets. They get to know people, and then they share the faith with them. But the question is how you can become close enough with someone to feel comfortable sharing your views while at the same time maintaining enough distance so that you're not influenced by their beliefs. And how will you work with non-Christians and socialize with them while at the same time making sure to keep them off of your list of potential partners? So the answer is you should ask the Mormons. They actually have the lowest interfaith marriage rate in the U.S., and the Mormons that I interviewed seem to confirm a general acceptance, actually, of mixed couples in their midst. The church's view of conversion is that if someone honestly investigates Mormonism, they will eventually accept it. So perhaps because the general assumption seems to be that non-members are simply members waiting to happen, the children of these mixed couples are not treated any differently than children of same-faith couples in the Mormon community. And actually, even among the church's most elite leaders, I found members who were the products of interfaith marriages, or marriages in which the wife or the husband converted after years or even decades of being together. So I was interviewing this Christian Science Mormon couple outside of Los Angeles, and they had raised five children together in the Mormon church, and the husband, you know, was still a member of the Christian Science church, and he loved the Mormon church but just didn't think that it was the truth. And the wife was sitting right next to him, and she just said, I expect someday, any day now, he'll come around. Very calmly, she was not harassing him. But the other funny thing about this couple was that the husband sort of had this tendency to cry. Was happy, whenever he got emotional about something, and he would start to shed some tears. And I just was imagining at the time, he occasionally gets visits from Mormon missionaries who want to try to teach him the lessons, and he doesn't mind. He sits there and listens to it. But I just imagine one of these missionaries, going back and saying, I broke him down. He was crying when I was talking about this lesson. I think I'm finally the one who turned him, but little do they know. Anyway, it turns out, I think, with the Mormon church that there's a lot to be said for a kind of, patient confidence that the spouse will eventually change. And like I said, I found a number of cases where they had. So the last group I want to talk about today is Muslims. So while many Americans are actually concerned about the radicalization of the population in the U.S., a number of Muslim leaders expressed concern to me that the Muslim population is becoming dramatically less religious with each decade. And only a fraction of Muslims in many American communities attend mosque even once a year. Jihad Turk, the director of religious affairs at the Islamic Center of Southern California, says that of the million or so Muslims in California, somewhere between 7 and 15% attend services at mosque on a semi-regular basis. And as time goes on, he actually expects that number to decline further. About 1 in 5 Muslims actually now marries outside the faith, and that is both a cause and effect of the growing secularization of the population. But there are other factors, too. Actually, according to the tenets of Islam, men are actually allowed to marry a Jewish or Christian woman, but the reverse is not allowed. So what happens is Muslim men marry out, and the Muslim faith is, technically speaking, passed down through the father. But this is America, and women run religion in America. They typically go to religious services more often. They read the Bible more often. They shuttle children to and from religious education. And so if you have a Muslim man marrying a non-Muslim woman, often what happens is the non-Muslim woman ends up deciding the religion in the household. Meanwhile, the Muslim women are left out of this equation because the Muslim men are going off and marrying non-Muslims. And so then they go off and marry non-Muslims as well because they can't find, again, eligible men around. So you see how this sort of pattern is going to eventually, once it spreads through the whole community, I think it will result in a lot of assimilation and secularization. And I think that pretty soon Muslims are going to look like Jews. So all in all, I think the rise of interfaith marriage is a bittersweet trend for American religious groups. On the one hand, it means they're moving away from traditional practices and that their children are less likely to become observant members of their faith. But on the other hand, it means that they have become thoroughly accepted into American society. Not only do large numbers of Americans seem happy to marry members of other religious groups, but when they do, they take their extended families along with them. Americans tend to have fonder feelings for people in a religious group after they've married one of their members, perhaps not surprisingly. But they also sort of now have these whole extended families, and suddenly your sister-in-law is a Mormon, and suddenly your first cousin is a Muslim. And interfaith marriage is basically becoming an important vehicle for assimilation, and I think a major driver of religious tolerance in this country. So a little bit about me. I am a Jewish woman married to an ex-Jehovah's Witness who is now an aspiring atheist, he tells me. I cannot claim to be an impartial observer of these trends, but I'm not actually rooting for the all-out victory of one of them or the other. America's history of assimilation and tolerance is the reason that I, the grandchild of Jewish immigrants, can have the life that I do today. It is the reason that I could marry the man that I wanted to without fear of being ostracized or worrying about whether my children would ever fit in. And I have to say that reading that 1964 book by Albert Gordon was very eye-opening. He talked not only about interfaith marriage, but interracial marriage and interethnic marriage. And he interviewed a lot of the children of these marriages, and a lot of them were just devastated. I mean, they really had no community. Neither family would accept them. In their hometowns, they were ostracized. And it was a picture of religious life that I did not recognize. And I think many of us would not recognize it today. So obviously, interfaith marriage has become so much more common, and interracial marriage for that matter, and interethnic marriage, that I think, we've provided this much more tolerant, and assimilated society for our children. And that is definitely one of the upsides here. But I also think that the strength of America's religious communities is an important contributor to this country's generosity and compassion, and not to mention some of its most important founding principles. So in other words, I would actually be sorry to see the waning of those religious traditions as a result of interfaith marriage. And it's true that interfaith families are less likely to raise their children religiously. Those who do must make real compromises on the way that a faith is practiced. And these are difficult trends for religious communities to weather. And then, finally, there's the institution of marriage itself, which has experienced its own decline in recent decades. Interfaith couples tend to marry, I think, without thinking through the practical implications of their differences. And they often assume that because they're decent and tolerant people who don't have anything against someone of another faith, and even commendably appreciate religious diversity in their communities, that they will not encounter any difficulties being married to someone of another faith. But here's the thing. Being in an interfaith marriage, I think, provokes conflicts and requires compromises that just living near someone or working with or being friends with someone of another faith simply does not. So we might think of these recent enlightened attitudes toward interfaith marriage as part of the racialization of religion, the belief that faith, like skin color, need not divide us. And there are those who believe that only a bigot would pass over a spouse on religious grounds. But I think religious identity, even in a completely tolerant society, can and should be considered more substantively than racial identity. Like religion, marriage is also an important foundation of American life, and I would be sorry if too many people entered into marriages that were unhappy or unstable. So for my own selfish reasons, as well as what I'd like to think are more broad-minded ones, I hope it will be possible to find a balance to keep religion and marriage strong while also fostering a tolerant society. But I do not know if that vision is ultimately possible. Thank you very much. Some questions?
I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that they're listening to Naomi Schaefer Riley, the author of Till Faith Do Us Part, in a lecture at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, and it's time for questions and answers. Who has the first question?
I was intrigued by your comment that you think there's more tolerance, because you hear the stories about the Palestinian marrying the Israeli and both families shun them, or the Orthodox Jew marrying the non-Jew and they still, mourn. So I don't see that in certain communities. You're from the Midwest, you said? No, you're from...
I'm from the Northeast.
I'm from New York. Mm-hmm. And so I just don't see that. So is it really a valid statistic that you think it's more tolerant?
I think that there are certainly communities where, will be shunned for marrying out. But the instances that, Gordon was talking about were, basically these children couldn't find a home. I mean, it wasn't just that they had been shunned by the community that they had come from. They also were being shunned by the community they were marrying into. And they also, even just on their own, were having trouble, just think about a mixed race couple in 1964 trying to find a place to live. I mean, it raises a whole variety of issues that I just don't think you see today. And to be honest, I mean, a lot of, there's been a decline in orthodoxy in America. So while, there are still, plenty of orthodox Jews out there, a lot of these interfaith marriages are not coming out of, the orthodox community for Jews, or, out of a very serious Christian community, perhaps, either.
Hi, I was wondering if you broke down in your survey on the religion, what the religion was based on sex. For instance, women are generally known to be more superstitious than men. And, I mean, your study to an extent displayed that. I mean, the reason that it's hard to get men to go to church is because men just are not as superstitious as women. And so, I mean, So I was wondering if you did that kind of study and also on economics. In other words, was someone who was an evangelical, let's say below the 50,000 mark, and a woman more likely to stick into a marriage than, say, a 200,000 plus
right.
a year?
And the answer is no. So, I mean, I did break it out, and the answer is no. There's absolutely there's no correlation between the likelihood that you will marry out and your gender, your income level, your education, or your location. The one slight exception to the location, and again, the statistical significance, there was a slightly higher percentage that if you were from the Pacific Northwest, you might be more likely to intermarry. But it was a very slight percentage. So other than that, there was no correlation between any of those demographic factors and the likelihood that you would intermarry.
Did that surprise you?
Yes. Oh, yes. I mean, I think, you know, I mean, I did interviews in Atlanta and I, you know, was expecting to, you know, find a different attitude toward it than, you know, in the Midwest and in the Northeast. And I was very surprised by that. And I think the age of marriage correlation, which is, as I said, the one kind of major correlation that I found is, you know, that tells you really, I think, what's driving this. And it's really the rising average age of American marriage.
The rising age, that's another question that I had.
Sure.
Did it have to do with second marriages? I mean, see, certainly some of those marriages would be second marriages.
Right.
I would assume of the older people.
Right. So even if you second marriages are more likely to be interfaith marriages, but even if you controlled for that, the higher age of marriage also made it more likely. And I think, you know, you can think of why the reasons for that. One may be, in fact, that people are not having children in their second marriages and they do not think that it will be as much of an issue to the extent that they think about it. Excuse me.
Other questions? One statistic that I saw that I found very interesting was that the marital satisfaction with the Mormons was 93%. Is that other studies show that too, or do the Mormons use this as a recruiting tool?
Well, I mean, marriage is obviously a huge part of the Mormon faith, and they believe that you are married in eternity.
Right.
So there's a lot of discussion about that, and you know I always say this, you know, a sociologist sort of, you know, creating the perfect religion to do all sorts of things, you know, make productive people, make people whose marriages last, would kind of, you know, take the same approach as the Mormon church has taken in a lot of ways. Mormons actually tend to get married at the age that most people think the happiest marriages are created, which is right around 23-24. Those are the marriages that are least likely to get divorced. And so that's typically their average age of marriage. But it also has to do with the way the whole community is formed around marriage, the family home nights that they have weekly. So those are a variety of factors. But yes, other surveys have found that Mormon marital satisfaction rates are very high.
From the outside, not from the inside, doesn't it seem a little odd that the Mormon faith, having started with polygamy, is the one that ends up, having adjusted because they wanted to become a state?
It is a strange feature of religious history that is the yeah. case. But this is their self-reported satisfaction, and it's women and men who are reporting that too. So
that's the general reputation they have.
Yeah.
And I notice you primarily stuck with Abrahamic-based religions. So did you get any respondents outside of the Abrahamic faith in terms of intermarriage? And also, this is, as a Darwin guy, why perpetuate this kind of stuff?
Okay, well, let me start with the first question first. So I could not get a statistically significant sample of Hindus or Buddhists. The Buddhist question, let's take the Hindus first. I couldn't get a statistically significant sample of Hindus. There were not enough of them in the survey. The Buddhists, the demographics range very widely. So if you ask some people how many Buddhists are, some sociologists, how many Buddhists there are in America, you'll get an answer around 3 million. You ask other people, you get an answer around 10 million. So people claim to adopt some Buddhist practices but don't self-identify as Buddhist. It's a much more sort of difficult religious group to measure in that sense. I did interview a number of couples who had, members of Eastern religions in them, and it wasn't... what should I say? I think some of the same issues arose for them, but I think, you know, both the couples and the religious leaders that I interviewed felt that these were faiths that much more assimilated truths from other faiths. And so this did not cause as much problem in terms of raising children or figuring out what to do. I interviewed, for instance, a Hindu Sikh couple, and you know they had two sets of altars in their home, and none of this you know struck them as very odd, and their families were all fine with it. And I think even in that case, though, the woman who was the Hindu, you know, was sort of much more in charge of what was going on, and I think her altar was a little bit more well used than the husband's, but that was just my opinion. So about your question about why perpetuate religion at all, I'm not really. In a position to answer that. I mean, I personally think religion has been greatly beneficial to American society, but this isn't really a book about whether or not to have religion.
To go back to the Hindus and the Sikhs, it's all Americans that you are talking to, and I mean, I would assume that the same issue in India, studied in India, would be very different because, for example, they won't even marry outside their caste.
Exactly. And that is that's a big issue for immigrants coming here. I mean, what you'll... One interesting thing that came up in my discussions, both with Muslims and Hindus, was that the first generation immigrants are often not even focused on getting their children to marry in the same faith. They're trying to get them to marry in the same caste and the same ethnicity. And so, a lot of religious leaders said this was hugely counterproductive because if you talk to a second generation, you know, Hindu or Muslim who's been here, the idea that they should stick to only marrying, you know, other Pakistanis or only marrying other Moroccans or something just seemed crazy to them. And so they almost wanted to reject the advice of the parents altogether on this, like, you know, oh, you're just so backward and old-fashioned that you just want me to marry somebody who cooks the same food. You know, this is nuts. And so there's been in some communities just a wholesale rejection of the older generation's advice when it comes to marriage because of that sense that this is more bigotry than it is a sense of wanting to continue the faith.
Next question.
Is this your next book, or did you cover the effects on children? You said you're practicing, but your husband is practicing like an atheist. I don't know if you have children.
Yes.
How does that impact them? Who do they follow?
So we have three children, and I told my husband on our first date that my children were going to be raised Jewish. So I'm the exception, certainly, in that part of people who talk about their faith ahead of time. I think, you know, this is not a longitudinal study. The Jewish community has obviously done a lot of its own internal studies about what the effect is on kids of being raised in interfaith homes, and there's certainly a sense that, you know, people in interfaith homes are less likely to observe, you know, the traditions of Judaism. But there are a lot of, I think, different factors that affect it. One of the things that I think that was interesting, I interviewed several people who were members of what are called mother circles. Some synagogues have now sort of started these groups for women who are not Jewish but who've agreed to raise their children Jewish. And they've sort of finally figured out what I was saying, which is that the mothers are sort of, not to be too blunt about it, but are what counts here. So there's a group basically where they meet and, you know, try to understand more about Judaism. Many of them do eventually convert, by the way. But even just to understand what their children are doing at preschool and to understand what's going on in synagogue, I think has been beneficial in terms of getting more of the participation of the mothers and in, you know, trying to ensure more of the children do end up practicing these things as they get older.
Do you have any statistics from your study? You said same faith versus interfaith. Of what percentage, you mentioned it, that some had changed, but what percentage had been an interfaith couple and now were a same faith couple? Because you might be able to split it down and say over time and how many years. You know, a lot of the ones that solve the problem of and don't get divorced might be ones where the one person has gone over and has become same faith. Where the dad caves in, yeah.
Right. Well, the other interesting statistic was it was exactly half and half in terms of who converted. It was half wives and half husbands.
Ah.
And I had all sorts of theories about what it was going to be, and I was just shocked that it turned out to be exactly 50-50. But I guess there are all sorts of things you could speculate. I mean, I think, you know, if it is the husband who's just sort of going along for the ride, you know, maybe you could understand that, or maybe, you know, I did meet a number of women who, you know, they felt faith, having the faith was important. What specific faith it was seems less important to them. And, you know, maybe for their, from their own perspective, you know, just making sure that the children had, you know, a one voice when it came to faith among the parents was important enough that they would convert.
So it's interesting. We've kind of given an explanation to a 50-50 thing, and the women found that the faith was more important because they were thinking about their children, and the husbands just caved. You know, and
it's all stereotypes.
That ends up being 50-50.
It is.
Do you, from your research, did you see any tips or best practices for people who are navigating interfaith marriage?
Well, I talked to a lot of religious leaders and marital counselors, and, you know, I will say, as far as sort of, obviously, and this will sound so obvious, but people who are not yet in the marriages having these conversations. I mean, it seems obvious, but then again, more than half of people didn't have these conversations, so maybe it's not so obvious. But I would say that once you're in the marriage, one misconception that a lot of people had, and I probably had a little bit myself, is sort of, you know, you decide about the kids and you feel like, okay, well, that side won. You know, okay, the kids are Jewish. Woohoo! You know, big victory for me. But these are ongoing conversations. And it's not that you're going to necessarily change the faith of the child, but, how your family practices is affected by all sorts of outside factors. So, you know, you decide, okay, we're going to spend Easter with Aunt So-and-so. And Aunt So-and-so's Easter basically consists of an Easter egg hunt, and that is about it. And, you know, she moves away one year. And then suddenly this family tradition, you have this question, do you go to this guy, you know, to your uncle instead? And your uncle actually happens to believe that Easter has something to do with the resurrection, and you should all go to Mass. And it sort of becomes this whole question of, well, how is your interfaith family going to navigate that? Okay, you're still, you know, you've still decided you're going to raise your kids, you know, Jewish or whatever, but how much of this other religious influence are you going to expose them to when it comes to your interfaith family? And I think that, you know, just keeping in mind that, you know, these conversations are going to have to be had over and over again. And as I showed you, even with the, you know, the chart where it showed trying to raise kids in both, you know, there, what I think you have the influence, in addition to just the time constraints that people have for raising kids in both, you also have the influence of just having older kids who want to make their own decisions. So how are you going to feel, you know, you've decided to raise your kids in both? Well, maybe Johnny gets to be the age of 13 and he's like, okay, Mom, I really like church. I really don't like synagogue, and you can't make me go, and neener, neener, neener. I mean, and so I think as a family, you know, you sort of have to figure out, you know, when you're going to let your child make that decision, if you're going to let your child make that decision. And to me, you know, just keeping in mind that these are ongoing conversations, I guess, was the advice that I got from a lot of longtime interfaith couples and, you know, marital counselors, too.
Well, the parents of the teenager that makes that decision should at least think that they're going to win in the long run, because
right,
whatever the teenager does then is bound to be what he changes later.
Right.
But you said about the winning. It reminded me of a Catholic priest that talked about being a marriage counselor, an unusual trait for them to be performing, but in any case, and he said that one of the couples that he had to deal with, they had a really long-term fight for 2 or 3 months over whether they were going to use Colgate or Crest toothpaste, because one had been raised Colgate, one had been raised Crest, and I think that comes back to your point, you know, that sometimes it's just about winning,
yeah.
You know, it doesn't really make too much difference, because he said his solution, which they'd never thought of, was to just have one tube of each.
Yeah. Well, that is a possibility. But I think the other, what I was going to say, reminded me about the Catholic Church. I mean, the Catholic Church actually does a very good job, a lot of other religious groups and even secular marital counselors say, about the premarital counseling. I mean, the questionnaire that's used in what's called pre-cana is actually the model for what a lot of secular religious counselors, marital counselors, use, because it gets you to envision all of these scenarios that are going to happen later in your marriage. And it's so, you know, extensive, you know, like 500 questions or something like that, that it really sort of concentrates the mind, I guess. And the other thing I was going to say reminded me was that the Catholic Church has actually changed significantly on the issue of interfaith marriage, particularly since Vatican II. It used to be that the non-Catholic partner was required to promise to raise children in the Catholic Church, and that is not the case anymore. Now, only the Catholic partner must say, you know, something like, we'll try very hard in the presence of the non-Catholic partner. But there's a sense that they need to respect the religious conscience more of the non-Catholic. And I think that's reflected a lot in the you know, marital happiness of the Catholic, non-Catholic marriages, that there is a sense of acceptance of the religious beliefs of the other member.
Do you think that has to do with their declining membership in this country? Because, I mean, I know a lot of Catholics, and I mean, when I go to their, you know, their services, their facilities are basically empty now. So I was just wondering if just the sheer economics is really what's causing this.
The Catholic Church membership has not declined significantly, actually. I mean, in part, it's because they have a lot of immigrants have come and filled the seats of a lot of people who have left the church. I don't think it interfaith. Well, I'll say a couple things. First of all, I did ask people how welcoming they thought their own religious congregation was toward interfaith couples. And this was very interesting because across the board, Jews, Mormons, evangelicals, whatever, about 70% or so said that they found their congregation very welcoming. That number dropped to 50% for Catholics. And I was shocked, I have to say. It didn't, you know, immediately strike me, you know, why that would be the case. I interviewed a few longtime observers of the church, journalists who write about Catholic matters. And the only thing that we could sort of come up with, a couple things, the sort of the way communion is done, which is to say, you know, if you are not a Catholic, you are not welcome up here, and people sort of, you know, stepping over the non-Catholics in order to get up. I think that might create one sense of that unwelcomeness. And the other thing, really, I think people just felt was that there was no, not much socializing after a lot of, it's sort of, you know, you go in, you get your communion, and you leave. And unlike a lot of Protestant churches where there's much more of the coffee hour or even synagogues where you have a kiddush, I think, people did not feel like the community was as welcoming to outsiders, at least at the religious institution itself. So I don't know to what extent that could affect the way, interfaith marriages, you know, choose or don't choose Catholicism.
Well, my mother was raised very strong Catholic, and her understanding was so narrow before, you know, Vatican II and even after, that she found watching the movie Fiddler on the Roof to be a life-changing experience because she had never, ever conceived that the Jewish people might not want their children to marry a Christian. She understood it the other way, but she had never, ever conceived that it could be done the other way, and she was almost 60 years old when she saw it, and it shocked her. And shocked her into a broader way of thinking, but that's how narrow the upbringing was.
Well, I this is how much the Catholic Church has traveled on this issue. I came across an article on the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops website that talked about Catholics married to Jews. And it said, not only do we have to respect the consciences of Jews, which is obviously a big part of Vatican II, but it also said that children should not be raised in more than one faith. And then it also said, and in Judaism, you know, faith is passed down through the mother. And it was just sort of very odd. It sort of left you with the impression that it might actually be okay if the child of a Catholic Jewish marriage is raised Jewish. And I'm not exactly sure whether that's the impression. I think that's the impression they meant to leave. I mean, I don't think they wanted to come out and say it like this was an official policy, but I think there was a sense that, you know, if you couldn't agree, we'd rather your kid be raised Jewish than be raised both.
Or none.
Right. Well, right, exactly. Or none, yes.
There's time for two or three more questions, if someone has another one.
What is the issue with both? What do you think about that? What's wrong with that? And talk in terms of, you know, tolerance and diversity.
With raising kids both?
Yeah.
The people that I interviewed, and this was true of same-faith, interfaith couples, religious leaders, and marriage counselors, all just said that to them it didn't seem fair to the children. Now, I will say that both is actually becoming more formalized. I visited a number of communities that were specifically devoted to educating children in two faiths. I visited one outside of New York and one outside of Washington, D.C. And these were kind of interesting, but basically they started off as a few families who felt like they wanted to find other families who were raising their kids both. And they grew into these communities on their own that were suddenly, you know, hundreds of families now. And they had their own, religious leaders who would preside over them. And the approach of the one that was in the suburbs of New York was they switched off. And so one week, they would learn about a Christian holiday, and the next week they would learn about a Jewish holiday. And they didn't ever want to have the children be confused and sort of try to mesh them into one message. I think the children were inevitably confused. I mean, I went to, I don't mean to make fun, but I went to a first grade religious school class, and they were in the process of discussing Passover. So the teacher was telling this story, and he said, and there was this, baby floating down the river, blah, 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 and he said, "Do any of you know who the baby was?" "Jesus." "Okay, so," and then he said, no, "not Jesus, it was Moses," and blah, 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 "and you know who picked the baby up out of the river?" "Yes, it was Mary." And so, it sort of went on like this, and I think, the other point I think that this group was trying to do was have it be a purely educational experience. They wanted the children, one of them said to me, to feel like they had a passport to each religion, that they would feel comfortable in the kind of vocabulary and the stories of each faith. And I think that probably they did achieve that. What seemed to be missing, from my sense of going there a few times, was the larger things that you hope your kids get out of religious education. There were they were trying to sort of focus so much on these different specific stories and keeping them separate that I think the messages that typically come along with these stories, Passover, they went through this whole discussion of Passover and slavery and blah, and there was no mention of kind of the values of freedom and, coming out, so in that sense, I think they were getting bogged down in a lot of specifics. Now, this is just my own few visits. I'm not saying this is true of all interfaith communities, but I think to me it illustrated some of the difficulties of trying to do the two-faith approach. Kids are getting lost in all of the specifics of each faith, and they're not, I think, getting a broad message. In part because the leaders of this community were trying not to do that. They wanted just for the kids to feel comfortable, not for the kids to walk away with a message, I guess.
It's a little like teaching two languages to children at the same time, right? That's confusing to the children before they're four or five, and then they sort it out. It's a lot harder when it's a belief about life, and they have disagreements between the two beliefs about life. I mean, if you try to teach creationism and Darwinism at the same time, and one father holds one, that would rather be difficult. You can't really, bring those together.
That's my question, because I'm obviously the insidious guy here. So my question is, like, let's say I want to strip the faith off of women. The best way to do that and raise them and encourage them to raise their children as human beings, as opposed to Catholic, Jew, Muslim, Hindu, would be to create a community for them. Because guys will pretty much just show up to get what guys want. But for women, what it really is about, like what you said in terms of the conversion, basically being equal, that the women who were willing to convert, that what they were converting for was a sense of community that they may not have had otherwise. Would that be a fair statement?
I didn't ask the women why they, first of all, the survey, included a very large sample of people. So of the people that I interviewed, the question of why they converted, or why they were willing to raise their children in a faith other than their own, is that?
You stated in one of your statements in terms of when we were discussing the 50%.
Right.
What you said was that women seemed to be, right, because you said it was equal, and that women were essentially looking for a sense of community. And I mean,
what I said was that they wanted their family to be raised in one faith. wasn't necessarily a sense of community, but they felt faith was important for their children, and they wanted their children to receive one message about faith. So even if that meant that was not the faith that they grew up in, some of the women that I interviewed said that was the reason they were willing to raise their children in one faith.
All right, so it's still basically an unknown, is what you're saying. Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you didn't really look for that. That was just a comment that you made.
Right. When I talked to women who were raising a child in a faith that they had not themselves grown up in. So there was one family I interviewed, and the husband was Jewish and the wife had grown up Catholic, and she'd grown up going to church every single week. And she met this guy and they started dating, and he basically said, look, this is my non-negotiable, my children must be raised Jewish. Now, what was funny was that he was not particularly religious. It was just, you know, this is his thing. You know, his mother gave him a big guilt trip about the Holocaust, and that was, you know, and that was it. And so, but when they got married, she agreed to raise the kids Jewish, she said, well, we're going to start going to synagogue every week because that's the way religion is done. And he was like, well, I didn't sign up for this. But I think, you know, what happened is she sort of, you know, imported the pattern of her own childhood faith onto this and said, you know, this is how our family is going to do it. And what's important here is that we're all on the same page religiously and we're all going to do this together. And, you know, that's, I think if you think back to that chart I was showing about how people, how spouses who attend church are more unhappy than the ones, you know, in interfaith marriages are more unhappy than the ones who are staying home. I think, you know, religion is a family thing in America. It's, you know, a lot of the members of couples I talked to who, you know, came, you know, to church with their children by themselves, mother who comes to church by herself with her children, she's kind of irritated. And I understand that, you know, I personally, it's supposed to be this family affair, and you look around and you think, you know, everybody's here with their family, and why am I just here, you know, with my kids or by myself? So I think that's one of the things that people have trouble imagining, you know, when they're just in the stages of dating. And they don't think to what it's going to be like at that point.
And that's a great way and a great talk. Thank you very much for being here. And for the radio and online audiences, we appreciate your interest. And so ends another discussion at the Commonwealth Club in its 111th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you.